Silas Marner by George Eliot. In the days when the spinning wheel hummed busily in the farmhouses, and even great ladies, clothed in silk and thread lace, had their toy spinning wheels of polished oak, there might be seen in districts far away, among the lanes or deep in the bosom of the hills, certain pallid, undersized men, who, by the side of the brawny country folk, looked like the remnants of a disinherited race. The shepherd's dog barked fiercely when one of these alien-looking men appeared on the upland, dark against the early winter sunset, for what dog likes a figure bent under a heavy bag? And these pale men rarely stirred abroad without that mysterious burden. The shepherd himself, though he had good reason to believe that the bag held nothing but flaxen thread, or else the long rolls of strong linen spun from that thread, was not quite sure that this trade of weaving, indispensable though it was, could be carried on entirely without the help of the evil one. In that far-off time, superstition clung easily round every person or thing that was at all unwonted, or even intermittent and occasional merely, like the visits of the peddler or the knife grinder. In the early years of that century, such a linen weaver, named Silas Marner, worked at his vocation in a stone cottage that stood among the nutty hedgerows near the village of Raveloe and not far from the edge of a deserted stone pit. The questionable sound of Silas's loom had a half-fearful fascination for the Raveloe boys, who would often peep in at the window. But sometimes it happened that Marner, pausing to adjust an irregularity in his thread, became aware of the small scoundrels, and though chary of his time, he liked their intrusion so ill that he would descend from his loom and, opening the door, would fix on them a gaze that was always enough to make them take to their legs in terror. For how is it possible to believe that those large brown protuberant eyes in Silas Marner's pale face really saw nothing very distinctly that was not close to them, and not rather that their dreadful stare could dart cramp or rickets or a wry mouth at any boy who happened to be in the rear? For Raveloe was a village where many of the old echoes of demon worship lingered, undrowned by new voices. Not that it was one of those barren parishes lying on the outskirts of civilization, inhabited by meagre sheep and thinly scattered shepherds. On the contrary, it lay in the rich central plain of what we are pleased to call Merry England, and held farms which, speaking from a spiritual point of view, paid highly desirable tithes. But it was nestled in a snug, well-wooded hollow, quite an hour's journey on horseback from any turnpike, where it was never reached by the vibrations of the coach horn or of public opinion. It was 15 years since Silas Marner had first come to Raveloe. He was then simply a pallid young man with prominent, short-sighted brown eyes, whose appearance would have had nothing strange for people of average culture and experience. But for the villagers near whom he had come to settle, it had mysterious peculiarities, which corresponded with the exceptional nature of his occupation and his advent from an unknown region called Northard. So had his way of life. He invited no comer to step across his doorsill, and he never strolled into the village to drink a pint at the Rainbow or to gossip at the wheelwrights. He sought no man or woman, save for the purposes of his calling, or in order to supply himself with necessaries. And the years had rolled on without producing any change in the impressions of the neighbours concerning Marner, except the change from novelty to habit. At the end of 15 years, the Raveloe men had just the same suspicions about Silas Marner as at the beginning. They did not say them quite so often, but they believed them much more strongly when they did say them. There was only one important addition which the years had brought. It was that Master Marner had laid by a fine sight of money somewhere, and that he could buy up bigger men than himself. But while opinion concerning him had remained nearly stationary, and his daily habits had presented scarcely any visible change, Marner's inward life had been a history and a metamorphosis. Marner was highly thought of in that little hidden world, known in his hometown as the Church Assembling in Lantern Yard. He was believed to be a young man of exemplary life and ardent faith, and a peculiar interest had been centred in him ever since he had fallen, at a prayer meeting, into a mysterious rigidity and suspension of consciousness, which, lasting for an hour or more, had been mistaken for death. Silas was evidently a brother selected for a peculiar discipline, and though the effort to interpret this discipline was discouraged by the absence, on his part, of any spiritual vision during his outward trance, yet it was believed by himself and others that its effect was seen in an accession of light and fervour. Among the members of his church, there was one young man, a little older than himself, with whom he had long lived in such close friendship that it was the custom of their Lantern Yard brethren to call them David and Jonathan. The real name of the friend was William Dane, and he too was regarded as a shining instance of youthful piety, though somewhat given to over-severity towards weaker brethren, and to be so dazzled by his own light as to hold himself wiser than his teachers. But whatever blemishes others might discern in William, to his friend's mind he was faultless. One of the most frequent topics of conversation between the two friends was assurance of salvation. Silas confessed that he could never arrive at anything higher than hope mingled with fear, and listened with longing wonder when William declared that he had possessed unshaken assurance ever since, in the period of his conversion, he had dreamed that he saw the words calling and election sure standing by themselves on a white page in the open Bible. It had seemed to the unsuspecting Silas that the friendship had suffered no chill from his formation of another attachment of a closer kind. For some months he had been engaged to a young servant woman, waiting only for a little increase to their mutual savings in order to arrange their marriage, and it was a great delight to him that Sarah did not object to William's occasional presence in their Sunday interviews. It was at this point in their history that Silas's cataleptic fit occurred during the prayer meeting. And amidst the various queries and expressions of interest addressed to him by his fellow members, William's suggestion alone jarred with the general sympathy. He observed that, to him, this trance looked more like a visitation of Satan than a proof of divine favour, and exhorted his friend to see that he hid no accursed thing within his soul. Silas, feeling bound to accept rebuke and admonition as a brotherly office, felt no resentment, but only pain, at his friend's doubt concerning him. And to this was soon added some anxiety at the perception that Sarah's manner towards him began to exhibit a strange fluctuation between an increased manifestation of regard and involuntary signs of shrinking and dislike. He asked her if she wished to break off their engagement, but she denied this. Their engagement was known to the church and had been recognised in the prayer meetings. It could not be broken off without strict investigation, and Sarah could render no reason that would be sanctioned by the feeling of the community. At this time, the senior deacon was taken dangerously ill, and being a childless widower, he was tended night and day by some of the younger brethren or sisters. Silas frequently took his turn in the night watching with William, the one relieving the other at 2 in the morning. The old man, contrary to expectation, seemed to be on the way to recovery, when one night Silas, sitting up by his bedside, observed that his usual audible breathing had ceased. The candle was burning low, and he had to lift it to see the patient's face distinctly. Examination convinced him that the deacon was dead, had been dead for some time, for the limbs were rigid. Silas asked himself if he had been asleep, and looked at the clock. It was already 4 in the morning. How was it that William had not come? In much anxiety, he went to seek for help, and soon there were several friends assembled in the house, the minister among them. While Silas went away to his work, wishing he could have met William to know the reason of his non-appearance. But at 6 o'clock, as he was thinking of going to seek his friend, William came, and with him the minister. They came to summon him to Lantern Yard to meet the church members there, and to his inquiry concerning the cause of the summons, the only reply was, "You will hear." Nothing further was said until Silas was seated in the vestry in front of the minister, with the eyes of those who to him represented God's people fixed solemnly upon him. Then the minister, taking out a pocket knife, showed it to Silas and asked him if he knew where he had left that knife. Silas said he did not know that he had left it anywhere out of his own pocket, but he was trembling at this strange interrogation. He was then exhorted not to hide his sin, but to confess and repent. The knife had been found in the bureau by the departed deacon's bedside, found in the place where the little bag of church money had lain, which the minister himself had seen the day before. Some hand had removed that bag, and whose hand could it be, if not that of the man to whom the knife belonged? For some time, Silas was mute with astonishment. Then he said,
God will clear me. I know nothing about the knife being there, or the money being gone. Search me and my dwelling. You will find nothing but £3.5 of my own savings, which William Day knows I've had these 6 months.
At this, William groaned, but the minister said, The proof is heavy against you, Brother Marner. The search was made, and it ended in William Dane's finding the well-known bag, empty, tucked behind the chest of drawers in Silas's chamber. On this, William exhorted his friend to confess and not to hide his sin any longer. Silas turned a look of keen reproach on him and said,
William, for 9 years that we have gone in and out together, have you ever known me to tell a lie? But God will clear me.
Brother, said William, how do I know what you may have done in the secret chambers of your heart to give Satan an advantage over you?
Silas was still looking at his friend. Suddenly a deep flush came over his face, and he was about to speak impetuously when he seemed checked again by some inward shock that sent the flush back and made him tremble. But at last he spoke feebly, looking at William.
I remember now. The knife wasn't in my pocket.
William said,
I know nothing of what you mean.
The other persons present, however, began to inquire where Silas meant to say that the knife was, but he would give no further explanation. He only said,
I am sore stricken. I can say nothing. God will clear me.
On their return to the vestry, there was further deliberation. Any resort to legal measures for ascertaining the culprit was contrary to the principles of the church in Lantern Yard. But the members were bound to take other measures for finding out the truth, and they resolved on praying and drawing lots. Silas knelt with his brethren, relying on his own innocence being certified by immediate divine interference, but feeling that there was sorrow and mourning behind for him even then, that his trust in man had been cruelly bruised. The lots declared that Silas Marner was guilty. He was solemnly suspended from church membership and called upon to render up the stolen money. Marner listened in silence. At last, when everyone rose to depart, he went towards William Dane and said, in a voice shaken by agitation,
The last time I remember using my knife was when I took it out to cut a strap for you. I don't remember putting it in my pocket again. You stole the money, and you have woven a plot to lay the sin at my door. But you may prosper for all that. There is no just God that governs the earth righteously, but a God of lies that bears witness against the innocent.
There was a general shudder at this blasphemy. William said meekly,
I leave our brethren to judge whether this is the voice of Satan or not. I can do nothing but pray for you, Silas.
Poor Marner went out with that despair in his soul, that shaken trust in God and man, which is little short of madness to a loving nature. In the bitterness of his wounded spirit, he said to himself, She will cast me off too. Marner went home, and for a whole day sat alone, stunned by despair, without any impulse to go to Sarah and attempt to win her belief in his innocence. The second day he took refuge from benumbing unbelief by getting into his loom and working away as usual. And before many hours were passed, the minister and one of the deacons came to him with the message from Sarah that she held her engagement to him at an end.